KOPN Columbia 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit. Stick around because tonight's going to be incredible. Dr. Jose Arguelles and the music of Canal. Good evening, good morning to you, good day to you, wherever you might be as you listen to this radio program. This is Mike Hagan, and you're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM, Mid-Missouri's place on the dial. All right, it is the 19th of March, 2007. Before we get down to business here, let's take care of our honors. Big thank you, of course, Debbie Johnson, Free Range Radio Theater, tonight doing King Lear. Wonderful stuff, as always. 1 hour before this program, 10 p.m. every Monday night, Free Range Radio Theater. Debbie does it. Before she does it, Kelvin and Jason do it. Jazz plus blues equals equinox harmony. Tech radio, as always, great stuff, keeping us up on the world of technology and all of our gadgetry. Jeff Wheeler starts things off on Monday every week from 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. with Uncommon Light. Great music, great talk, great radio every Monday. on KOPN, your imagination station. Glad to be a part of it and glad to be here with you all tonight. All right, thank you to everyone who listened and participated in the program last week. A big thank you to Dr. Willie Gaspar, author of The Celestial Clock and also The Sacred Cosmic Marriage, tying together more ancient mythology, language, symbology, coming up with conclusions that are rather chilling in Willie's case. At any rate, 2012 is what he's looking at, and that time period, again, being pointed to through Dr. Willie Gaspar's lens, however, a catastrophic time for many on this planet. In particular, massive Earth changes brought on by the Sun, which is in turn being affected by the central Sun of our galaxy, the galactic core, and the energy emitting from her. So, once again, you know, we'll see. But thanks very much to Dr. Gaspar for giving us his ideas and viewpoints on the program here. We also heard some new independent music, great stuff from a band called Anchando. Of course, you can check it all out on the web if you missed it, the talk with Dr. Gaspar, or you just want to hear the tunes. It's all up there on the web, www.mikehagan.com, in the program archives. Go check it out for yourselves, share it with your pals, and if you want to send me a note, let me know what you think. I'd be glad to hear from you, okay? All right, tonight I am extremely honored and equally thrilled to welcome Dr. Jose Arguelles to the program. We'll talk about time, the noosphere, 2012, center of the galaxy, calendar reform, shamanism, and what he thinks it all means. We are really, really fortunate to have him with us tonight, and it'll be an abbreviated interview, only an hour long, so we planned, and we'll see how much we can get covered in that amount of time, but in just a bit, at midnight, we'll have Dr. Jose Arguelles on the program, okay? We'll also have some great music from Canal, this great band that I came across a few months ago and was trying to come up with a good program to share their music with you, and I couldn't think of a better one than with Dr. Arguelles. So tonight we'll have the music from Canal, and we just heard a song called Gypsy at the beginning of the program there. We'll hear more from them throughout the program tonight, including a brief interview, actually, with the lead singer of the band, whose name is Soul. And I spoke with him a few weeks ago, and I'll play that interview for you and play some more music from the band in just a little while here. You know, if you're interested in the music that you hear on the program here, it's all on the website as well. I feature independent artists every week. I try to pick stuff that sort of matches the tenor of the show and the interview, and hopefully the whole thing works together. When it does, it's quite cool. When it doesn't, well, it's usually not that bad anyway. But anyway, lots of great music, whether it matches the guests or not. You can find all of it in my music archives on the website, okay? It's at www.mikehagan.com. And I think with that, I know it's only 10 after the hour, but there's a lot going on tonight, and I want to make sure I've got everything in place. So let's play another song here from Canal. This one's called Space Child. And you guys just chill out, grab a beer or a cup of coffee or water or whatever you do, and we'll be back in just a minute, okay? I got a lot to talk to you about. We got a great interview coming up, and then we'll have an hour after the interview with Dr. Jose Arguelles to, I don't know, cover some other things, and we'll see. I'll try to talk him into staying longer, you know? We'll see what happens. Anyway, it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. This one is called, what is it called? It's called Space Child. Yeah, I don't know if that's for me or anybody else, but that's what it's called, Space Child. Canal on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. It's Radio Orbit. We'll be back in just a few minutes. right, that's called Space Child. Another great piece of music from Canal. It's Mike, you're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN, Columbia, Missouri. 89.5 FM, right in the middle of nowhere, as it were. Hello to everyone listening to us this evening on KOPN, the traditional airwaves, or over the web, live or otherwise. Every Monday, we broadcast a show from the wonderful studios here at KOPN in lovely downtown Columbia, Missouri. And we also stream the show live on the web, on the internet, at kopn.org. Just click on the Listen Live button, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Hopefully, you'll hear whatever's happening right here where I'm sitting. All right? 64K stream, real nice sound, and we're really lucky and proud and pleased to have it up and running. Been doing it now for about a month and a half, and couldn't be more happy about it. So great job to all the people here at KOPN that made that happen. And we also have some friends at another place called Cosmic Waves Radio. And I thank them as well for getting the stream out there to everybody as well. And that's a little bit of a lower bandwidth stream that I set up thanks to the people over there at Cosmic Waves. And that's a 24K stream, but it's great for people if you don't have a real faster, speedy connection. Okay? All right. Thanks to everybody, regardless where you're at, whoever makes it happen. We appreciate it on the web and on the radio. Also, thank you to Larry, my great friend, Larry Norwich, the web wizard, as always. He's back with us, but busy as always. He's in the process of a big move off the continent, as a matter of fact. And anyway, my best to him and his family. He's got a lot going on right now, but he'll be back with us, trust me, okay? And hopefully he's listening to the show. I don't know if he is or not, but I hope he is. All right, thanks as well to all the people out there who've been sending art, music, poetry. There's some great new stuff in the Poets Corner, and it's just wonderful. I love it. Thank you. Send more, more, more. We'll find a place for it on the web. I'm going to do a photography section pretty soon, I think, because my friend Will, who's just the best photographer around, has got some great stuff that he'd like to have sort of a vehicle for that sort of, you know, is off the beaten path from the stuff that he typically does. And I'm sure there are lots of other people out there that have great photography they'd like to share with us. Bob, I know out there, would love to. He sends me a lot of stuff personally. But anyway, we'll do that pretty soon, hopefully. And we've got a lot of other things going on. So, all right, if you want to find out, go on the web. Check it out, www.mikehagan.com. You can take a look at everything we're doing there. No passwords, no nothing. All right, just go there and see what you will. I tried the whole password subscriber thing for a while, and I really wasn't a big fan of it to begin with because I'm into sort of free access. But it's sort of nice also to know who's listening and where they're at and if you want to send an email to everybody and all that. But at any rate, it didn't work very well because we just got hacked incessantly from the moment we began doing that. And ever since we have been just sort of leaving the whole thing wide open, you know, we haven't had any problems, knock on wood. So at any rate, if you go on the website at mikehagan.com, you can have access to everything, you know, and the archives and links to all the musicians. And there's even a real cool forum that's there, sort of a bulletin board where lots of the people who sort of frequent the program, listen to the show, and snoop in and out of the website, they hang out over there a little bit. It's actually sort of a neat little community that's sort of building. At any rate, it's a bulletin board, you know, in the empirical sense, and it's just a place to post stuff. Write what's on your mind, write what you think is going on. You can post stories from the news or whatever, you know, and then other people comment on whatever's being talked about, and there are whole thread, you know, whole threads then develop. And it's interesting, actually, to see the whole thing go. But there's some great stuff over there, really interesting topics always being discussed, and a really valuable archive of sort of historical information that's being built over there. So anyway, I can't keep up with it. I used to be, you know, sort of responding all the time to every different post or whatever. But as much as I'd like to, I'm just sort of, you know, I can keep up with the ones that I'm, you know, sort of the ones I like or the ones that sort of strike me, and the other ones that sort of have their own lives. So anyway, we have that going on. There's a live chat room that's up and active right now. Hello to everybody over there who's listening in, and I'll peek in there for comments and questions during the program. I don't know how much we'll be able to squeeze in. I'm going off of our original plan that we'll only have about an hour to talk with Dr. Arguez, so you know, just to bear with me. But I encourage our guests as well as listeners to join us in the chat room, in the forum, all these places. And I also encourage communication between you guys and me. and between my guests and musicians that are on the program. So if you want to get a hold of me directly, the best way to do that is Orbit Radio, O-R-B-I-T-R-A-D-I-O, orbitradio at AOL.com. And you can always get to me through the website as well. But like I said, I appreciate hearing from everyone. And guests, musicians alike that are on the program, they like to hear your comments and, you know, insights and questions as well. All right, so if you want to do that, like I say, the way to do it is on the Internet. You know how to do it. MikeHagan.com, contact me or figure out a way to get it to contact anybody else you'd like to through me. All right? Okay, let's see. Let me take a few minutes here and talk about some upcoming guests, and then I'll do, well, we'll do Space Weather after I air this interview I did with the lead singer from Canal, the music that we're listening to tonight. His name is Soul, and he's a cool guy, and we had a nice talk a couple of weeks ago. So I'll play that in just a few minutes here, but let's talk about some guests that are coming up on the program. And, well, it's exciting for me tonight for sure, March 19th, for the Equinox, of course, which is about 24 hours around the corner now. Tonight, though, Dr. Jose Arguelles. And just absolutely thrilled to have him on the program. And he's in New Zealand, as a matter of fact, right now. And so we'll cross our fingers and say a quick prayer to the technology gods that we work everything out. I haven't actually got him on the line yet, but I'm sure we'll do that without hassle. You see what I mean? And we're going to have a great program tonight. I'm really excited about it. Next week, Eric John Phelps. Certainly a switch of gears. But we've been doing the 2012 thing for a little while here, and we're going to move on to some earthly matters. This one in particular, the author of Vatican Assassins. We'll also have the music of a band called Exit Clove that I ran into last week that I really like. They're a local regional band here in the Columbia area and making great music here in town. Okay, Eric John Phelps, like I said, next week. On the 3rd of April, that's the anniversary of my friend Terrence McKenna's passing in the year 2000. It'll be 7 years. And I'll do something special for T. On the 7th of April, I'm not sure. I've got a whole bunch of things sort of just not quite scheduled yet, but you can plan on hearing these people in the next coming weeks and months, okay? John Major Jenkins again. Paul Stamets, we'll see. Still working on it. Patrick Flanagan, someone that I've had some requests for, Dr. Patrick Flanagan. We'll talk about alternative energy and some really interesting things that he's involved in. A gentleman named Gary David, who's interested in the relation between the constellation Orion and the Hopi, as a matter of fact. And I have a friend in the Hopi community down in Hopi Land in Arizona whose name is Grandfather Martin. And he is an amazing person who taught me some very, very profound and helpful things in my own life. And anytime I hear things about the Hopi, I look at them pretty closely because Grandfather Martin is an elder and a shaman of the people there. And he has spoken to me and to other people in a way that, you know, gives you a reasonable amount of discernment when you see other people talk about the Hopi. Anyway, Gary David is an interesting person who's written about them, and I'd like to have him on the program. So we'll see about that coming up soon. Dr. Richard Tarnas, the author of Cosmos and Psyche. He also wrote Passion of the Western Mind a few years ago, which was a big, big book. Amazing what Dr. Richard Tarnas has been doing. But anyway, his recent book is called Cosmos and Psyche. And for people who have read it, it's made quite an impact. And we'll have Dr. Tarnas on the program soon. Susan Weed, still working on that. It would really help if you guys contacted her. Barbara Ehrenreich, working on it. Richard Allen Miller, my friend Ian, recommended it, and I fully concur. And I'm sorry he wasn't on the list earlier. But Richard Allen Miller, I'll do my best to get him on the program sometime soon. Got great music from bands like Spangl, Marcy Playground, Mankind Liberation Front, Devochka, this band Exit Clove that I told you about. Anyway, all that stuff's coming up in the next weeks and over the springtime into the summer, okay? And we are welcoming in the springtime, at least I am, tonight on the radio. It is the spring equinox. We'll talk a little bit more about it when we do Space Weather after Well, after this interview with Soul from Canal, and, well, anyway, it's a great night, and hopefully a wonderful spring and summer for myself and everybody else out there listening, and, well, everybody else everywhere, I guess, okay? All right, let's see. Well, I think let's do it, okay? This is coming up right now, an interview that I did with a young man whose name is Soul, T-Z-O-L, and he's the lead singer and one of the writers and a musician, plays guitar too, and some other things with this band called Canal. And I spoke to him just a couple weeks ago, and I'm going to let you hear what he had to say right now. And check out their music on the web, by the way, at Canal, K-A-N-N-A-L.org. And I think they have the MySpace thing as well, but I'm sure you can track that down if you like, all right? Okay, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. We'll be back in about 15 minutes or so live. In the meantime, enjoy this interview I did with Soul from Canal. Hi, it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit. Welcome back. I've got a gentleman on the line with me here from Denver, maybe Boulder, Colorado. He goes by the name of Soul, and he is a member, one of the founding members, I think I should say, of a band called Canal. And I was introduced to this band by a listener of the program and got in touch with their management, or at least someone who works with them, a wonderful woman named Carol. And so tonight we've got an opportunity to talk with Soul a little bit about their music, and without further delay, we'll do that. So, hey, Soul, hi, welcome to Orbit.
Thank you, man. Good to be here.
Yeah, pleasure to talk to you. I've been sort of chatting back and forth with Carol for a few months now. I've been listening to your music in between as well, and really think you guys are doing good stuff, and I'm glad we had a chance to talk to you for a minute.
Great, man. I appreciate it.
Okay, look, other than what I've heard, I've got this wonderful CD that's called Dreamwalker that was sent to me, but I know very little else about the band. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and a little bit about Canal and what you guys are up to, okay?
Okay. Well, right now we're actually recording in the studio again. We're making our new album. It's called A Myth Magic,
right?
And it's sounding amazing. We actually wanted to get away from doing kind of the standard like Pro Tools or Cubase systems, and we met this man who has a system called Sonoma, which is a super audio recording. And so it just sounds really stellar, so we're really excited. And myself and Tiaro, our lead guitar player, are producing the record. And so we've been, you know, it's been a couple months now we've been at it. We all took a little break, went down south to Mexico and Guatemala, which is actually where the whole band met, you know, over the past, I think it's almost like 6 or 7 years ago that I met Tiaro down in Guatemala. We were both just kind of backpacking musicians doing our thing, and you know, I heard him playing one night, and I was like, dude, you gotta play some lead guitar in my songs. So he's like, sure, and then we started, and we haven't stopped since, and it's been an amazing journey.
What took you to Guatemala? Where are you from originally?
I'm from Austin, Texas.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow, some good music going on down there, too.
It's great, man. It's such a great city. I miss it quite often, you know. The only problem with Austin, Texas is that it's in the middle of Texas.
You know, it's funny. What a strange and green part of Texas. You know, I actually love Austin, but I'm not
it's
a big
great.
Fan of the rest of the state, you know?
No. No, none of us really are. All the musicians and artists and freaks of Texas end up in Austin.
That's sort of like Columbia, Missouri, actually, and like Boulder, Colorado, too, I guess. So.
Yeah, Boulder's very similar. Boulder's like a smaller version of Austin.
Yeah. Well, that's where the band is based out of now, out of Boulder?
Yeah, out of Denver, actually.
Out of Denver, okay. Mm-hmm. How many members are in the band, and tell us a little bit about your sound?
There's seven of us. You know, there's six are musicians. One of those musicians bounces back and forth between vocals and doing a theatrical dance.
Mm-hmm.
And with her partner, Akeite, who designs like all of the outfits and stuff that they wear. Because what we're up to is like taking the songs and taking the music, but then doing these theatrical kind of interpretations to the music itself. And so it becomes more than just, you know, five musicians kind of noodling around on stage, and it's more of an interactive theatrical experience.
Yeah, I've seen one of the videos that you guys have up online, and it's awesome. You've got all kinds of swirling dancers and rhythms going on, and all kinds of old ancient instruments maybe, and combined with new technologies and all that sort of stuff too, though.
Exactly, you know, and that's kind of what we're up to. You know, it's almost like this ancient futuristic sound all in one, you know, mixed in with like great songs, because we definitely stick with, you know, writing verses and choruses and bridges and all of that.
Yeah, it's great music, no question about it. I've really been enjoying it.
Cool.
Let's talk a little bit more about the influences from south of the border. There's obviously a Mayan theme that runs throughout the music and through the band itself. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I would say, you know, we all met down in the land of the Maya, no question. But I wouldn't say that our music is influenced by any sort of Mayan music or anything. It's more of I think all of us have been inspired by kind of indigenous cultures and tribal cultures.
Mm-hmm.
So we kind of blend in the tribal sound from all over the world. Like our drummer built his own drum kit out of, you know, he definitely had like the standard drum kit, but then on the side of it, he built in tablas and darbukas and djembes and dunduns. And so those are like, go from the Middle East to Africa and all over the map, really. So we're pulling out percussion from all over the world, as well as didgeridoo we have in there,
right,
which is a prominent part of our sound.
Right.
You know, and then you blend that tribal feel in with the rock guitars and, you know, melodic vocals, and you get Kanal.
Huh. Very cool. All right.
Yeah, but for some reason, all of us were definitely drawn to going south. You know, like I said, one year I met Tiero, and then he and I got together and made a record. We went back down south, and that's when we met our bass player and our drummer and one of our dancers, and there's something with south of the border that just definitely inspires Kanaw and brings us alive.
Do you know who Jose Arguelles is?
Oh, yeah.
We're going to do a show sometime in the next 2 months. I'm hoping to air your music on the same night as I talk to Jose.
Oh, that'd be awesome, man.
Yeah,
he's been an amazing influence in my life, man.
Yeah, he's an amazing guy. And
he's incredible, dude.
What do you know about Jose Arguelles?
Well, you know, I've read a couple of his books, like the Surfers of the Zubuya, and the Mayan Factor, which was just phenomenal.
Sure, the Mayan Factor. That was sort of the thing that launched him, yeah.
Totally. It's a great book. Yeah,
yeah, I've been fascinated by his work for years, too. I read lots of his earlier stuff and then was totally blown away by a book he did just a few years ago that's called Time and the Technosphere.
Well,
and,
I haven't seen that one.
Oh, man, he's just over the top, you know, and just outrageous. And
one of the things with Jose was I heard that he had, like, a big awakening in his own life in Palenque, Mexico.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's actually where I had my whole vision of Kanal, was in the exact same place. And
very interesting. There's something special in a lot of these places that are down there in Central and South America.
Yeah.
And the indigenous cultures and the shamanic traditions that come from there just persist and are getting stronger and stronger.
They're awakening all of us, Canadian, and all of us around the world, you know.
It certainly some of us, that's for sure, Sol.
Yeah.
So, all right, well, let's take a break here and listen to a song then. We'll come back and talk a little bit more with Sol from Kanal. And in the meantime, this is called All Things Change. Back in a minute, this is Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN.
precious of the gonna ever stay the same. La 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 la.
All right, there you have it. All Things Change. Soul, great music, great stuff. Tell us a little bit about where that came from.
You know, it's interesting. That was actually one of the first songs that I wrote after the whole incarnation of Kernel. And it's pretty, basically, it's kind of documents my own personal awakening of realizing that, you know, there's something greater out there for myself, you know, as well as for all of us, you know. And once we come to that place in ourselves that there's kind of more going on than what we're used to in our own lives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it brings us to those edges. You know, and it's also just the basic truth of, man, all things are going to change.
That's for sure.
You can try to hold on to whatever it is, be it, you know, your love or your job or your life in general. You know, it's going to change. So it's best just to kind of let go and go with the flow.
No question about it. Nothing lasts, that's for sure. We know that.
That's right. It's more important just to understand that, realize that, and just love as much as we possibly can in the moment.
How long has the band been together? You guys been together, you said, 7 years, I think?
But Tieto and I have been together 7 years. The full band has now been together for 4.
Wow.
Yeah.
Awesome. And in the studio again?
In the studio again, man, and loving it. You know, we've spent so much time as touring and being a live act.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really inspired right now by the studio and learning how to bring that energy that we can conjure up live into the studio.
Yeah, that's got to be a challenge because from what I've seen, the live performances are certainly something that seemed to me, at least as sort of a person who's familiar with music and recording, that would be a little bit more difficult to capture in the studio.
Totally. You know, and nor you don't really even want to try that
in a sense.
Because they're two different ballgames.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the Kernel live show is off the hook, man. It's so much fun, you know. And we're going to be recording all of our live shows from now on, and we're going to do a live CD as well.
Do you have any plans to do any webcasting or anything like that?
Oh, yeah. We're getting all of that tighter.
Right on.
You know, we're going to be casting all sorts of new songs in the web, as well as new video. We're really getting into video and recording shows and making little, you know, little, like, three-minute kind of promo things of what we're up to.
You and I were talking a little bit off the air about the just the technology and the new softwares, as well as the communication technology, the internet, et cetera, that's allowing us to share this stuff. But man, it's gotten a lot simpler for folks like you to put stuff onto recording, or whether it's audio or video. You can do some amazing things now.
It's amazing, man. And I've always been inspired by video, but I've never gotten into it, and now I'm kind of really checking it out. I have an idea, like our next tour that we do, the summer tour we're going to do, I'm going to capture a bunch of footage and then afterwards, you know, come back and then put, like, you know, a feed on our website showing, like, what it's like touring with Kernel and stuff.
Right on. What? Let's talk a little bit about tours. What do you have planned for the year?
There's lots coming up. We probably won't go out until the end of May, but I saw something happening out in New York, which is actually the first time we were going to hit the East Coast.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really excited about that. So we're going to be going out there. We're playing the Wakarusa Festival.
Right on.
We're playing High Sierra, it looks like, probably out at Burning Man, Earth Dance. There's a lot of festivals for us this year, which is really great because when you play a festival, that's when you can reach a lot of people really quick.
Right.
You know, and that's really helpful because otherwise you end up just touring and touring and touring in these bars and stuff, and it's kind of draining after a while.
Mm. Where's Wakarusa? Is that Lawrence, Kansas?
That is Lawrence, Kansas, exactly.
Wow, you know, you're not far from Columbia, Missouri when you're in Lawrence, Kansas.
The other thing is I haven't seen anything, but we might play in that area because that's usually what we do. Get like a good festival, and then we'll stay in the area and do a few club dates at the time.
Yeah, I'll have to talk with Carol about it, but there's a few club owners around here in town that are good friends of mine that have real cool venues and would probably make a nice home for you guys for an evening, maybe.
Great, man. That sounds like fun.
All right, listen, I'm going to wrap it up with you. We've got to get on with the program here, and I'm going to be featuring Canal for the rest of the program tonight. But, hey, great stuff, and tell the rest of the band to keep on keeping on, and you're making great music, and I can't wait to hear more of it.
Awesome, Mike. I'll do that, man. Thank you.
Right on. Hey, so what's the name of the new CD? You got a name for it yet?
Yeah, it's called A Myth Magic.
A Myth Magic. And, as I mentioned earlier, the one I have is called Dreamwalker. You can find lots of information about the band on the web at www.canal.org, K-A-N-N-A-L.O-R-G.
Yep.
All right. Thanks again, man. Take care of yourself, and we'll catch up with you, all right?
Awesome, Mike. You too, bro.
Everybody, that's Soul from Canal, and we'll hear some more music of theirs throughout the program tonight and in the future. All right, everybody. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. I'm back with you live here. Hope you enjoyed that talk we had with Soul, the lead singer and musician in a band called Canal. We've been featuring their music tonight. We'll hear some more from Canal throughout the program, okay? All right, let's see. It's about quarter to midnight on the 19th of March, 2007. Wonderful night, beautiful night here in Columbia. And I hope it's a nice night where you all are listening to the program. We got about 15 minutes to the top of the hour, at which time we will welcome Dr. Jose Arguelles to the program. And looking very forward to it. I know lots of you are too, so stick around. That'll be great. Coming up in just about 15 or so, okay? In the meantime, let's do space weather. And I have an announcement I think that I can probably fit in. Maybe we'll do it after we speak with Dr. Arguelles. But at any rate, the equinox, as I said, 2007, the vernal equinox. It occurs at about midnight universal time on the 21st. That's basically 24 hours from now, plus or minus 15 minutes or so. It's about 5 o'clock on the West Coast in the U.S., and I don't know what it is where you are, but the spring equinox upon us in 24 hours, okay? This does mark, of course, the beginning of spring in the Northern Hemisphere, of course. You know, and we're speaking to Dr. Arguelles from the Southern Hemisphere. He's down in New Zealand, so it's actually the autumnal equinox down there. But wherever you live, happy equinox, okay? And speaking of solar and, events in the heavens, there was another eclipse. There was the lunar eclipse that occurred, a week and a half ago or so, but there was a solar eclipse this morning, as a matter of fact. If you were in, India, for example, something was missing. A big chunk of the sun was missing when it was rising, and it was a really beautiful sunrise eclipse this morning on that in that part of the world. Some nice photos of it up on the web, of course. And that hidden chunk of the sun was, of course, behind the moon, which passed in front of the sun for about 4 hours at about 2:30 in the morning, again, Greenwich time. And you got this partial eclipse that was visible from India, probably across China and Russia, all the way, even up into Alaska. From, the way that the angles worked out this time. So, anyway, beautiful stuff in the sky, and look for signs in the heavens, they say, you know. Anyway, okay, what else? Speaking of that, a new comet. You know, I love comets. I've been talking about comets so much over the last few months with the coming and going of that amazing comet McNaught that Kent and I had such a great time observing and talking about in the later months of last year. But anyway, here's a new one, okay? This one's called Lovejoy. You gotta like that. Comet Lovejoy. On the 15th of March, just a couple of days ago, this guy in Australia, speaking of the Southern Hemisphere, down there in Oz, Terry Lovejoy, this guy's name. And as most of my listeners know, these discoveries in the heavens very often get named after the people that discover them. Well, good for Terry Lovejoy. Couldn't have a better name for an equinox comet. And he discovered this comet on the 15th of March. It's in the, well, you know, it's in the direction of the constellation Indus. And again, this is the southern constellation. Now get this. The guy didn't find it with a telescope. He found it with a camera. He found it with a camera. Honestly, a Canon 350D. He even shows the camera and everything. Anyway, he took a picture and thought he saw what he did see, and sent a request to another guy named John Drummond, who's at an observatory down there in New Zealand. Again, I guess it's a whole southern hemisphere sort of night for us here. But anyway, this guy, John Drummond, confirmed the comet, and there's some photos of that, again, up on the web. You can go over to spaceweather.com to see some of the stuff, and I'm sure Kent's got some stuff up at his site at cyberspaceorbit.com. All right? All right, what else? Well, this comet, one more thing. It's not bright enough yet for the unaided eye. It may be. Who knows? They've been tracking the thing for 4 days now, and they seem to have figured out its trajectory. Listen to this. They say the orbit is cockeyed, almost perpendicular to the rest of the solar system. At the moment, the comet is swooping up from below, moving from southern to northern skies, at closest approach to Earth, 0.44 astronomical units. For those in the know, that means about 40 million miles or so. 0.44 astronomical units means 4.4 tenths of the distance between the Earth and the Sun, the average distance, like 93 million miles. So it's about 0.44 times 93 million, and I digress, all right? It's 50 million miles away, plus or minus. Comet Lovejoy. It's expected to brighten to about the seventh magnitude. That's still not naked eye, but easy to see through a telescope. I mean, this guy took it with a camera. I don't get it. I guess maybe it's the digital technology now is getting outrageous. I guess that's the lesson there. At any rate, another comet going to swing by our neck of the woods. I love it. I love joy it. Okay, what else? New moon, basically tonight. Full moon, 2 weeks from now. And welcome to spring, okay? All right, I want to mention somebody important, an announcement of sorts. You know I do this from time to time. There was a wonderful, wonderful woman who was born on the 17th of March in 1894, and she's no longer with us, but a happy birthday to Maria Sabina. If you're unfamiliar, Maria was the Mazatec curandera from Oaxaca, Mexico, who, as fate would have it, ran into Gordon Wasson, Robert Gordon Wasson, on his trip to Mexico in 1955. And as a matter of fact, on the 19th of June, close to the solstice, actually, in 1955, she introduced Gordon Wasson, and hence the Western world, to a healing ceremony. And he was the first, followed shortly after by his wife, Valentina, to experience the effects of the psychedelic mushroom, the visionary plants that Maria and many of the shamans in this culture and those cultures used in ceremony, sacred ceremony. And Gordon Wasson wrote about this experience with Maria Sabina and the psilocybin containing mushrooms in an article for Life magazine in 1957. And actually in the article, Wasson referred to Maria as Eva Mendez in an attempt to sort of protect her privacy. But obviously it failed, and over the next many years, Maria Sabina and much of what she knew was shared with visitors from the United States and other places around the world. There was an onslaught of young people, hippies, you know, and this sort, came in search of God, all this stuff. They disrupted the whole scene down there. And in fact, she was arrested a number of times. And, you know, the federales were all over them. And there were times when she had to turn people away. There were times when she introduced them to the ceremonies and to the mushrooms that they sought. People like John Lennon, supposedly. I mean, a lot of this stuff is sort of apocryphal. But, you know, certainly many, many people did go down there, and remarkable things came from it, for good or bad. You know, Maria left this world sad. You know, she believed that it had, a sacrilege had sort of occurred. But, you know, she never charged any money or anything like that. Maybe once in a while, who knows if she needed something. But anyway, she died 1985. She was 91 years old. But she was absolutely wonderful, and another one of these people that has to be remembered. So, Maria Sabina, to her, all right, her birth, and a good Irish toast as well. Mazel tov or not, you know? Okay, that's March 17th, you know, she was born on St. Patrick's Day. Let's see here. Let me go to the news real fast and see what's happening in the world. We got a couple minutes. I'll play a piece of music here in a couple. And then we'll have Dr. Arguez, Dr. Jose Arguez, at the top of the hour, midnight, okay? All right, let's see. Rain causes rock slide near Yosemite to shift. And another story, reports of weird underground rumblings. The paranoid in me would say they're related. Oh, I'm just kidding. Let's see, NASA says there's ice on the Martian South Pole. What is this, a news flash? What do these guys do? They just repeat the same news over and over. You know, the Mariner probes from the 60s and the Viking probes in the 70s, which actually landed on Mars, and they make a big deal like it's that hard these days. You know, they knew there was plenty of ice on the planet, and they probably knew there was liquid water, which there's plenty of evidence now. To support that, but it's weird how the official agencies just refuse to sort of look at their own data. I mean, the Mariner data, we have. You can look at it. You know? It's not my data. What else? So, golly gee, NASA says there's ice on Mars and South Pole. All right, big deal. Say something that you haven't said. Or that hasn't needed to be said for 40 years, okay? What else is on here? Ancient city under Antarctica. I don't know. Species under threat. Honey, who shrunk the bee population? Oh, man. This is one that I'm actually interested in. There's actually a woman whose name is Bee Wilson. Believe it or not. Beatrice, I'm sure it's short for. But anyway, Bee Wilson wrote a book that I've liked for a couple of years, but I have neglected to get a hold of her and get her on the program, but I think that now's the time because she's an expert in bees. And not only bees today, but the history of bees and the products that they produce and the plants that they make friends with and you know, and help move along on their own evolutionary agenda. Anyway, hopefully I can get Bee Wilson to come on the program. We'll talk about what the heck is happening with bees. Apparently there's a whole bunch of trouble in the bee world, and this is big business, you know. I mean, literally, you know, for the people that are capitalists, this will even bother them, because bees do a lot of work for them, and you can't pollinate a lot of crops and a lot of flowers and a lot of things without honeybees, and there's trouble, apparently, in the honeybee world, and, you know, and big surprise, you know, there's trouble all over the place because of the imbalance all over this planet. So get used to it. And hopefully things will straighten themselves out shortly. And we'll talk about that, as a matter of fact, with Dr. Jose Arguez in just a few minutes. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM on the web. Mike Hagan, HAGAN.com. And KOPN, of course, on the web at KOPN.org. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll be back in just a few minutes. This is Canal, and the song is called Time.
People come and then they go, and that's just the way it goes. Listen to what we know, like water we shall flow back to the ocean soul in the body of the Lord. Welcome home. Time to reap what you sow. Time is overwhelming me. I just hope this time forever. La 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 love, yeah, time is overwhelming me. And I hope there's time for everything. Why do you want to fight? You separate the wrong from right. That's the enemy. Why don't you choose to see the better way? When work becomes your play, hey, come look inside, unveil where you hide. Time is overwhelming. I just hope there's time for everything.
To Radio Orbit with Mike Hagan on KOPN 89.5 FM.
Alright, everybody. It's been nearly 54 years since my guest was called to his path. From the early 1950s, he has pursued one goal that has led him from the pyramids of Teotihuacan across the globe, through the harmonic convergence of 1987, and now toward the usherance in of a new heaven and a new earth. He's recognized around the entire planet and has written many books along the way, including The Mayan Factor, Earth Ascending, Time and the Technosphere. He holds a PhD in Art History and Aesthetics from the University of Chicago. He's taught at numerous institutions, including Princeton University and at the San Francisco Art Institute. He is a true liberator of magic and a shaman of an extremely high order. It is an absolute honor and a privilege to welcome him to the program, Jose Antonio Arguelles Valum Votan. Welcome to Radio Orbit. Thank you so much for being here.
Hey, well, thanks a lot. That's a great intro, Mike, and it's great to be here with you. And as you know, I'm talking to you from New Zealand, Aotearoa, the land of the long cloud, where it's already tomorrow.
Well, thank you so much. And we don't have a whole lot of time. Speaking of time, it's all about time these days. And let's get right to it. So that's the first question, of course, Dr. Arguelles. Time, what is it? The Western idea, linear, a straight, flat line. How is your notion of time different?
Well, reality is only like cosmic time. And the cosmic time, everything is instantaneously simultaneous. And when we speak of time, we're speaking of relative degrees of what we're doing to our consciousness. So when we talk about Western time, we're talking about the mechanization of time, the putting of time into very discrete mechanistic units, minutes, hours, seconds, nanoseconds. And this is actually a process of consciousness, because as we become addicted to this notion of time, we actually accelerate all of our perceptions, we accelerate the mechanistic projections of our biological functions into a massive entity which we call the technosphere. And as we progress with the evolution of the technosphere, in time, as we experience it subjectively through our senses and our everyday mind, time accelerates more and more, so it seems like we have less and less time to do more and more. People are running around frantically, accomplishing what they hope are meaningful things, making what they hope is sufficient money to buy more meaningful things, and not really knowing what's going on. In fact, becoming more and more disconnected from the actual cosmic reality and their own true divine essence. So this is the type of time that we have created and invented out of our own ignorance.
And the clock is the vehicle, the mechanical vehicle.
The clock is the vehicle that that the human species used to mechanize time. Once time was mechanized, then the rest of our biological functions could be mechanized. The curious thing about that, you will notice, is that once the time was mechanized, then there was just no question. Every succeeding technological innovation was immediately grasped, cherished, and believed to be absolutely of inestimable necessity to the continued evolution of our species. The more that we became hooked on every succeeding new technology, of course, the more and more we disconnected ourselves from our true nature. So when you have a biological species that has actually become a planetary organism, much like a type of galactic virus, is operating on a type of timing system or timing frequency that increasingly disconnects it from the natural order, well, disaster is bound to happen.
All right, the law of time. You came up with an interesting way to look at time through a different lens, so to speak, that has to do with this ratio of 13 to 20. Could you talk about the law of time?
Talk about the law of time. What we're talking about is a singular law, like the law of gravity, which everything, the law of gravity, everything in the material world abides by that. Everything gravitates to a central point and creates denser and denser objects in space, which then we call stars and planets. Well, and they all operate by the law of gravity. Well, the law of time is a higher unifying law that says that everything in the universe is unified, is synchronized simultaneously at the same moment. As we speak, this actual same instant of our speaking is actually occurring in an instant of time that cuts right across the universe. You say, well, the other side of the universe is 10 billion light years away, or 15 billion light years away and with the Big Bang. That takes a long time to get there. But time itself, the synchronous nature of time says that in actuality, this instance of time cuts radially through the whole universe. That through telepathy, time is what is faster than the speed of light. And telepathy travels on time waves, so by telepathy traveling on time waves, our conversations could be monitored by entities or beings of higher intelligence or consciousness billions of light years away from us, should they be curious about what we're doing on this little sphere rolling around this little star.
How does art figure into this? You have this interesting equation that's and a wonderful image associated with it on one of your websites, and I actually should mention that really quickly since we already mentioned the law of time. To see lots of this stuff and links to all kinds of very interesting information, everybody, go take a look at the website, www.lawoftime.org. And there's one other one that I should mention really quickly called Tortuga, TORTUGA.com. Pardon me for that, Jose, but I wanted to get that out there. Back to our conversation, this equation, time multiplied by energy equals art.
The actual equation is energy factored by time equals art.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, everything is in the universe is synchronized in time. And as we often say, have you ever seen an ugly sunset? Have you ever seen an ugly nighttime sky?
Mm-hmm.
Only if human conditions are such that ugly effects are created.
Mm-hmm.
In principle, everything that exists in the universe is synchronized by time. That's what it means. Energy factored by time equals art. And everything that is synchronized by time, everything that is synchronized in time, actually has an aesthetic quality. It's actually a living, natural form of art. You know that by looking at a rose, or you know that by looking at a flower of any kind. You know that by walking through the forest. You know that by looking at the nighttime skies. You know that just by feeling the ocean when you're alone on a beach someplace and just feel the waves coming in one after another. This affects our perceptions. Just the way that we experience all of that as a sense of what we usually refer to as beauty, that the nature itself is an unconsciously evolving work of art. We ourselves, as mediums of higher consciousness, being also evolved by this nature, are capable of creating more conscious, self-reflective forms of art.
Mm.
The more beautiful our self-reflective forms of art are, the more they conform to laws of synchronization. What we find most beautiful, most having most effect very often is when we are involved in some type of mass participatory event that is unified by some type of artistic performance, such as a rock concert.
Mm. I love it. It reminds me of the Platonic concept where he said that the good would also be true and would also be beautiful.
It's the true, the good, and the beautiful. The principles that govern the thinking of the Platonists and the Neoplatonic thinkers, and also of the Pythagoreans, who all these people, in essence and in principle, understood what we're talking about, that energy factored by time equals art. It's just that how we came across this, how we discovered this, is what we call basic law of time. How we discovered it was through our study of the Mayan calendar. And the Mayan calendar, we noticed that the basic mathematical system of the Mayan calendar is based on a ratio, which we determined was a ratio frequency, a constant frequency, 13 to 20. And this constant frequency of 13 to 20 runs through everything in the universe. Everything is operating on this frequency is being synchronized by this frequency, would be better put. And through the studies that I continued to pursue on this matter, I saw how this frequency actually runs through virtually all aspects of nature. You can see how this appears. For instance, very few of us know that in the ancient Hindus knew this in the study of the system of what they call the nakshatras, is that the moon moves across the sky 13 degrees in 20 minutes every night. That's an example of this frequency.
Right, right, right. There are relations to the human body as well, are there not?
There definitely are. Just at a very simple, very obvious level, we live in an age of great complication, and very often it's very difficult for us to see what's right under our noses. 13, 20, we have 20 fingers and toes and 13 major articulations in our body, 2 ankles, 2 knees, 2 hips, 2 wrists, 2 elbows, 2 shoulders, that's 12. And our neck and central column is the 13th. So
right.
We are 1320. We are what the slogan is that we say about in defining further the law of time is that time is art.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, everything that is in time, when you take the time to do something, as they say, then you are actually manifesting in an aesthetic way as an artistic form, a very form of our own bodies with the 20 fingers and toes and our 13 articulations. We actually are manifestations of a higher art form. We just have not arrived at the consciousness to fully appreciate that as an individual or as a species for the most part.
What does the calendar have to do with it? Maybe we should talk about calendar reform.
Well, when we talk about calendar, most people, just take calendar for granted. Most people think that April, May, June, September, all of that's kind of etched in the DNA or in the cosmos, or it has always been, and thus it shall always be. And give a little thought to it, which is actually what that calendar wants you to do. Give a little thought to it.
That's what all calendars are meant to do, right?
We're talking about the Gregorian calendar, which is the actual world calendar. That's the world calendar that we're operating on.
Mm-hmm.
If we live in a rational society like Mr. Spock comes from, we never would have used the Gregorian calendar because, as Spock would say, why, that's illogical.
Why would he call it illogical?
Irrational. Why would a rational species that prides itself on its ability to use logic and reason and to be logical and systematic, why would it use something that's so illogical? That's the point. When we talk about illogical, we simply mean the old adage, 30 days past September, April, June, and November. All of us have 31 except for February, and then leap year has 29. We're dealing with two systems, a system of measuring months. A month is a very inaccurate concept. The idea supposedly is that the month is supposed to correlate to a synodic lunar cycle. A synodic lunar cycle is 29 and a half days.
Mm-hmm.
The month are either 30 or 31 days, except for February, as the adage has it. Those don't clearly correspond to a celestial or astronomical cycle, if that's what the intent is. Further, the subcycle of the calendar system is the 7-day week. With the exception of February, none of the months correlates to a 7-day week. So as a result, it's like using a measure, a yardstick, that some of the units are in centimeters, some of them are in inches. They don't conform. And as we often say, if you ask someone to build a house with a ruler like that, you would be living in a very crooked house.
Mm.
And we do live in a crooked house. Our calendar is something that shapes our mind, and we live in a crooked world.
Isn't that the truth?
No question about it. You just have to, mind my saying so, look who's running your country.
Well, I know there was a time years ago where this was actually brought up at the UN, calendar reform and what we might do.
It was brought up in the UN up as recently as in 1956. In fact, I was just reading the other day that even in 1949, the Royal Astronomer of the United Kingdom promoted the 13-month, 28-day calendar.
Mm-hmm.
This calendar was promoted avidly in the 1930s. There was a great movement of reform in the predecessor to the UN, the League of Nations, to adopt as a new logical calendar the 13-month, 28-day calendar. The main objection to this came very vehemently, of course, from the Vatican, which has a vested interest in the Gregorian calendar, who created it who bestowed it upon the world. So, this, as I said, this was brought up to the United Nations and was presented as recently as 1956. It was brought up by the Committee on Social and Economic, the Social and Economic Committee, and then it was tabled. Other matters like the Cold War and the arms race seem to have taken up more and more interest, and the matter was pushed in the background. From our analysis, the more it was pushed in the background, the more the effects of operating on an irrational system took over.
Mm.
The more the effects of operating on an irrational timing system took over, the less inclined were people to think outside the box.
Mm. Let's talk a little bit about the 13-28 calendar. 13 times 28 is 364. People think about 365 days and a quarter or something like that in a year. Talk a little bit more about the calendar that you would suggest that we might look at.
Well, this calendar, the 13-28-day calendar, first of all, it is a calendar that was universally used by many, many prehistoric peoples before the rise of civilization. The Druids, for instance, or the ancient Incas. It was one of the 17 calendars used by the ancient Maya. The Polynesians used this calendar. You go just about anywhere and you scratch beneath the surface and you say, oh yes, we did have that at one point. When we talk about a calendar, many people think the calendar is supposed to be an object for an instrument that conforms to some type of precise astronomical measure. The problem with an instrument that conforms to precise astronomical measure is that we're looking at things from a very limited point of view and a very relative point of view, and the points of reference themselves are always changing. So it's very difficult to base something on that. The actual relationship of the moon to the earth, for instance, we talk about the synodic cycle of 29 and a half days, which is from new moon to new moon, and this is something that makes a lot of people go crazy. But there's also the sidereal cycle, which is 27 days.
Right, right.
The 27-day cycle is based on when the moon returns to the same place at a point in the sky. Then there's other cycles. There's an even more obscure cycle, the axial cycle of the moon, which is a precise 28-day cycle, and that has to do with the inclination of the pole returning to the same place every 28 days. So the point is that if you try to create a measure based on astronomical data, it will be very difficult to come to a very precise notion. A whole other realm of thinking about this is that principle of harmonic measure, that what you're looking at is a principle of harmonic measure. When you look at the cycle of the Earth being 365 days, let's just start with the whole number there, and you'll see that 12 doesn't go into that. 12 is 360, and then 5 days are left over.
Mm-hmm.
Ancient Babylonians had a 12-month calendar that then had those 5 extra days as a five-day cycle. 12 months is 30 days plus 5. But if you take 365 and you divide 13 times 28 is 364.
Right.
The 7-day week, 4 weeks, 28 days. 28 days, 52 weeks equals 13 months. of 364 days, you have a perfect harmonic congruence of units of measure. The 365th day, which was known in ancient times, is known as the day out of time. It is no day of the week at all. This is what the Vatican didn't like. In the calendar reform, they called that null day, N-U-L-L. Back in the old days, when they had that, they heard that expression, long live the king, the king is dead, long live the king. That referred to the day out of time. That on that day, the previous cycle was considered complete. There was a day when there was nothing, no cycle, and where everything, sins could be absolved, debts could be forgiven, and then the next day would begin a new cycle. The king is dead, long live the king. And that's the meaning of that. So, this is the same principle that, we've been promoting with the 13-month, 28-day calendar, that this calendar has its, what we call synchronization point corresponding to July 26th. Was originally a point that was measured as the rising of Sirius. Sirius was conjunct with the sun rising on that morning.
Mm-hmm.
And then the 364th day of the year, the 28th day of the 13th moon, corresponds to July 24th. And then the 20th, corresponding to July 25th, is then this day out of time, the 365th day of the year.
Mm-hmm.
The quarter day that accrues is referred to as a total 00 day, which if you need to have that, occurs every 4 years.
Right.
And then all of that is correlated. The main point that we're talking about, if you have a harmonic standard, a harmonic system of measure, then you are actually going to be straightening out your mind. You're going to be harmonizing your mind and your life. There are much research that shows that these 28-day cycles have a great galactic and cosmic validity, and that by creating a standard of measure that's harmonic and following a cyclic pattern that's harmonic, that then we will make our lives increasingly harmonic. We live a very disharmonic life. In the 13-month, 28-day calendar, the measure of the moon becomes even more precise than it is in the present calendar. And precisely every 19 years, the moon will return to the same spot on the same date on this calendar. If there was a full moon, for instance, on July 26th, In 19 years, that pattern would repeat. The point also is that with the harmonic standard, you are moving the concept of time into a higher state of consciousness, into a higher dimension of mind. And you are developing a system of what we call synchronic harmonics, the synchronization. Things become more and more synchronized. You become more and more aware of the nature of synchronicity when you follow a harmonic standard that is always placing you in harmony with the other cycles and forces of nature.
Amazing. All right, another one for you here. I've read three of your books, Earth Ascending, The Mayan Factor, and Time and the Technosphere. Time and the Technosphere blew me away. You talk about moving from the technosphere into the new sphere or the noosphere. I'd like you to talk about that and the 1987 harmonic convergence and how these things are all related.
Well, what we're talking about here, when we talk about the biosphere, we have to talk about the biosphere, the technosphere, and the noosphere,
mm-hmm.
and the relationship of the harmonic convergence in 1987 to these three terms, biosphere, technosphere, noosphere. And to the critical junction that's just coming up 5 years from now in 2012.
Absolutely.
Now, when we talk about the biosphere, we're talking about the sphere of life as we know it on Earth. We can look at the planet as a sequence of spheres coming up from the core. the lithosphere, which leads up to the tectonic plates, the hydrosphere, which is the oceanic system, the atmosphere, the magnetic fields. The biosphere is the sphere of life that exists as a thin film connecting the hydrosphere and the atmosphere on the crust or the surface of the lithosphere. And this biosphere, you have to understand, is a unitary system. All of life is one. It represents a spectrum of degrees of organisms from unicellular organisms up to Homo sapiens. And this represents a spectrum of processes of chemical metabolizing of different elements that are within the surface of the Earth. The biosphere can best be defined as the region on Earth for the transformation of cosmic energy. If the Earth is being continuously bombarded with solar and cosmic energy, the plants directly transmute the solar energy into chlorophyll and releasing and generating the oxygen carbon dioxide cycle. The other, those plants, those types of life are called autotrophic life. They subsist just by themselves on the minerals of the earth, on the water, and on the sunlight. The other type of life is the heterotroph. That's basically all the animal forms of life up to us. The heterotrophic life lives off the plant life. The plant life is independent. The heterotrophic life lives off the plant life. These two, what you might call great phylum of life, of existence, create what's called the biosphere. The biosphere is a continuously evolving dynamic. It is continuously processing atomic structures, molecular structures, transmuting them. Every time we transmute some form of energy into another form of energy, that actually then becomes the words coming out of our mouth as we talk. And this process of the transformation of life and the evolution of life into ever more complex forms gets to a stage where we have the appearance of intelligence. We can look at this matter again as there is inert matter and there is living matter. We represent living matter. Living matter evolves in complexity, particularly a brain and nervous system, until it reaches a point of capacity for self-reflection. This is what is called intelligence. Mm-hmm. The species attains the capacity for self-reflective intelligence. We call that the stage of harmonization, becoming human. Now, it could be that when we use this, we don't necessarily mean that all forms of self-reflective intelligence look like us.
Right.
They could look like ET. They could take other forms. But they all have the same capacity, whoever they are, for self-reflective intelligence. When you have self-reflective intelligence, then you have a new phenomenon. You have the capacity for thought or consciousness to affect the material plane. When you have that, then you have the beginning of what's called the noosphere, the mind sphere. In other words, the processes of the mind can create images. The images can be communicated and transmitted and put into a type of form where they actually become manifest. Henry Ford thought of a car. That was an image in his head. He knew certain things and certain principles. He said, I think if I do this, 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 and this, we'll get this. We'll have a car and it will run.
Right.
The atomic bomb was just an idea. First, someone said, if we do this, if we split this atom here, and we contain it and put it in this type of container here, and we use it as a projectile, it will create such and such an effect, and it will scare our enemies, and it did. It still does.
Mm-hmm.
Those were all thoughts first, but they're examples of how thought affects on consciousness, which doesn't seem to have any material reality. No one has ever actually said they measured a thought or seen a thought, yet this thought, which seems to be some type of electrical charge, is able to manifest and completely impact our environment. We are experiencing today something called global climate change. And even now, more and more people, scientists, I should say, included, are in agreement. We had something to do with global climate change.
Mm-hmm.
We had something to do with global climate change because of the effect of our thought. The mechanization of time is the effect of our thought. All of this effect of our thought is the beginning creation of the noosphere. We haven't understood the power of our mind. We have just been like kids let loose in an amusement park where there's no rules and it says whatever you think you can create.
Right.
We don't know how to take responsibility for that. And now we're at the place where we have to pay the price for this type of so-called freedom. This creates the possibility of self-awareness, of self-regulation, self-reflective consciousness that will take us to the next stage of our reality, which is the noosphere. Between the biosphere and the noosphere is the technosphere. The technosphere is the unleashing of the mechanization of thought into all the different forms that we experience in the world today. First, you have the mechanization of biological functions, such as locomotion, train, bicycle, automobile, the airplane. And then we have the projection of thinking itself, of the processes of thought itself, into the computer technology, into the creation of a sub-sphere within the technosphere, which is the cybersphere. And
right.
The cybersphere is the world of the information technology. The cybersphere is actually the virtual noosphere. It accomplishes everything that telepathy does, except for it relies on electronic instrumentation to do so.
Right.
Your noosphere is the functioning of the human organism as a single mental function, as a single mental being or entity that is operating by pure telepathic means, that it is in touch with itself wherever it is on the planet, and it is doing this without the intermediary instrumentation of the internet. This is what is ahead of us. This is past the threshold of 2012. The pure noosphere, the evolutionary advance into a purely telepathic mental field.
Without technology.
Without reliance on this technology, which, you know, is very costly. People should be aware of the fact that as much as they love the internet, as much as they love MySpace, as much as they love YouTube, you know, there's a blog that happens every 8 seconds. You can figure out how many blogs, 10,000 blogs, new blogs a day.
Mm-hmm.
There's 600 billion web pages and only 6 billion humans. The cost of that in energy is that by 2010, which is only 3 years away from now, the internet will be utilizing one half of the electricity on the planet.
Remarkable.
You have to think about that. That's just to run our information media so we can talk to ourselves, so we can show off our egos and display all of our opinions, whether we're informed or not. And in the meantime, the energy cost is that phenomenal. The spaces, without moving into nanotechnology, but the spaces that are utilized by search engines for Googleplex and these other companies take up an enormous amount of space, 500,000 square feet for a search engine. That has to be housed in remote areas where they create more ugly eyesores.
Right. They got to keep it all cool and all that business.
Yeah, and that's keep it cool. That's the electrical thing, is keeping it all cool.
Mm-hmm.
You just know from running your little PC how hot it gets.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. All right, 2012, Why is 2012 significant? And let's talk about the galactic core, why that's so important.
Well, the significance of the 2012 was first spoken about in the 1970s. If you look at the back of my book, The Transformative Vision from 1975, you'll see in on page 301 of this a reference to 2012 at the end of the closing of the Mayan Great Cycle of 5,125 years. A few years later, in The Invisible Landscape, Terence McKenna also arrived at the 2012 date. Some entirely different means, which I think is very important.
Yeah, through the I Ching and his whole method.
In the 1985 and 86, we talked about this, and what was significant to us is that we each arrived at that date from different means. Is that the 2012 is actually a point in time marked and known about by the ancient Mayan civilization. The call date of December 21st, 2012 is the call date to the day for Ahau in the Mayan long count. And this date marks precisely the conclusion of 1,872,000 days since the beginning of this particular cycle, just the cycle, not the end of the calendar, beginning of this cycle on the day August 13th, 3113, or as some people have it, August 14th, 3114. Doesn't matter too much.
Right.
What we do know is that this cycle comes to close. Now people say, what is the meaning of the cycle? The meaning of the cycle, this is the cycle of history as we know it. If you went back to August 13, 3113 BC and went around the planet, it would be a relatively pristine place. A few little communities here and there, but if you went into the Nile Valley or to Mesopotamia, you would see that there are a couple of developments. The first dynasty in Egypt, 3100 BC, the first city, as it's called, this urban center in the cycle of history, Uruk in present-day Iraq, 3100 B.C., and in India, at 3102 B.C., the disincarnation of the last avatar of Krishna. And those are all right about the same time. The Mayans knew that 3113 B.C. is actually the beginning of a cycle. They knew, it's also interesting, you go back and read and you see that the ancient Sumerians around 3100 BC knew how to divide the day into 24-hour periods, 60 minutes each. It took some 4,500 years before it got translated into a clock.
Right, but that's when the actual
that
mathematics...
That was known at that time, and that was a knowledge that came from elsewhere that was planted here at that time, a type of star planting, which began the acceleration, the cycle of acceleration. This cycle from 3113 BC to 2012 is a cycle divided into 13 sub-cycles. Each of these is called a baktun. Each baktun, the 13 baktuns, each is 144,000 days. 144,000 times 13 is 1,872,000 days, the cycle of history. The 144,000 days is the number in the book of Revelation, and that is a very specifically chosen number, the number of what's usually referred to as the number of the elect, the minimum number of those on the planet at any time during this cycle who are in operating in conformity with the truth, no matter what their spirituality or religion or whatever else it may be. The last cycle of 144,000 days began in 1618, the beginning, precise beginning of the scientific revolution, the point in time when the clock had become standard and the beginning of the mechanization of time. Since that period in 1618, this last less than 400 years, the processes of human civilization have accelerated exponentially because of what we refer to as the establishment of the artificial timing frequency, 1260, the regular 12-month calendar in combination with the mechanistic 60-minute hour, which has created a frequency that is both highly mechanistic and seemingly rational, the clock, and fairly irregular, the Gregorian calendar. So it's a combination of highly irregular and mechanistic has created the what we might call the crazy-making mind of the modern world. Where everyone has to be at work on time, but no one's really sure whether they really like their job. So that's the world. And so this cycle is seeing it comes to an end on December 21st, 2012. What does that mean? What that means is that when you look at what's happened to the planet in the last 400 years, what's happened to the planet in the last 260 years, you'll see that particularly in the last 260 years, that we have absolutely transformed. We have become a geological force on the planet, impacting the planet like nothing ever known before as far as a biological factor affecting the actual geology, the environment, the climate. Nothing has impacted, no form of life has impacted the planet like that before, at least as far as we know, and certainly in this cycle of planetary history as we know it. And this, what we have come to is that we are in a stage where we are in an exponential curve of population, of pollution, of extinction of species, and of the actual climate change is now an irreversible fact. There will be no Arctic ice cap in the year 2040. The oceans are going to be rising, and the recent study that was put forth by the IPCC, the International Panel for Climate Change, now it turns out that they were giving us this word about the Arctic disappearing, the Arctic ice disappearing by 2040, and now it turns out that their findings, when they were presented at the end of early February, when those findings were presented, those findings were greatly modified by the pressure of national governments because they said it would create too much alarm. Well, you can weigh whether you want to create more alarm now or you want to have greater panic in 3 years. And any way you look at it, we've come to a point where the processes engendered by history have come to a climactic, irreversible point where the human species no longer really has control over what it has set in motion, nor does it seem to have the moral will to be able to try to stop what it has set in motion. And so you come to an inevitable point, a climactic point, which we are now actually in the process of reaching. By 2012, you might say the bubble of history will have burst, and we will be entering an entirely new chapter of evolution. How this bubble bursts, there are many different possibilities. Certainly, certain forces are already in motion. Aspects of climate change, weather patterns changing. I heard you talking about this bee phenomenon, for instance. That bee phenomenon appeared on the BBC News front page.
Wow.
Last week. And it says, vanishing bees threaten U.S. crops. It is officially called colony collapse disorder.
That's right.
The more pithy way of describing it would be vanishing bee syndrome. And as many as 95% of the bees seem not to have shown up this year for duty.
Yeah, it's weird. Like they look at hives and they're empty.
Bees pollinate 40% of the crops. The almond crop in California, for instance, is considered it's not happening this year. That's big business in California.
Yeah.
This is big business everywhere. And why is this happening? This is not just in this country. Bees are disappearing all over. You find out that they're disappearing here in New Zealand as well. Yeah. Why is that happening? We run, as I said, we're like kids that lose in an amusement park that says, try this, do that. And no one ever, you know, when we invented the car, we didn't make a study on it. What would its effects be in two generations? When we invented the personal computer, no one made a study on it, what its effect would be even in one generation.
Mm-hmm.
The impact of our technologies upon ourselves, upon our psyche, and our environment is so far out of control. We don't know. This is a big debate now. Did the bees disappear because of pesticides, its cumulative effect of pesticides, or some other more mysterious factor?
Mm-hmm.
There was a show about the bees on the Animal Discovery Channel, and there was a quote attributed to Einstein, which said, Einstein said that when the bees disappear, then there'll be only 4 more years for the human race.
Is that
now,
what
the bees disappear this year and next year is 2008, 4 more years takes it to 2012. The point is, we are looking at the end of time as we know it, the end of the world as we know it. And things are going to be coming more and more out of shape. So it's time to get ourselves spiritually straight and take responsibility and see what we can do to salvage some semblance of spiritual truth and reality to survive into 2013.
Jose, what do you think, then, individual actions? In other words, the entire system is one of chaos and disequilibrium right now, so people must be able to do things to help themselves and their fellows. Advice?
We just have to be taking our own responsibility for our own lives and taking our own lives in our own hands and basically, I think, getting into forming our own collectives and communities with those people that we know, we trust, and who understand, like, this is the situation that we're in right now.
Mm-hmm. All right, another question. I speak German, and in the German language, there's a word that's called Ursprach, and
mm-hmm.
and it's
primal language.
Yes, I'd like you to talk a little bit about that.
Well, you know, all the traditions say that originally we were one being, and we came as one race, or we came from one place. Our DNA shows that we're more connected as a species than virtually any other species. Even though it seems that we have black people and white people and yellow people and brown people and so on. Originally, and this gets also to the Tower of Babel type of thing, originally it says that we came from one soul and that the soul then multiplied and we came to a place then of what you might call the primal forgetting. But up to the time of the primal forgetting, we spoke one language, this Ursprach that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
This is a telepathic language. This is what's called fundamentally the telepathic language of trust. One thing that we have lost totally in this world, particularly in countries like the United States, is trust. There is no trust. Instead of trust, we have massive, horrendous security systems. Everybody's afraid. Everybody's projecting fear. And it's becoming more and more intolerable to travel on international flights or go through airports. And we've lost the trust. You know, we have just allowed this process to escalate. And when you lose the trust, then you're in the final stages of Babel and of Babylon, where you're as far from the Ursprach as you could get.
Hmm.
Well, we think that when we get past this threshold of 2012, that we will also be experiencing a quantum shift of our own consciousness and synchronization with higher orders of reality, which you might call cosmic civilization. The cosmic civilization operates on a telepathic system, and therefore it operates on a cosmic trust system, and operates by a type of universal language, which we will once again begin to understand. And that happens only because we are in community. Talk about the bees. The bees live in community. How do they maintain their community? How do they build their hive? How do they know what to do? They don't have grammars and dictionaries and encyclopedias and internet. They have system, instinctual system of knowing and communication with each other. And that's their Ursprung. So we have lost that, and now we're paying the consequences for having lost it. We've created a huge, as I said, babble of internet with 600 billion web pages, but we don't have peace, we don't have unity, we have fear and intolerance. And so we have to move out of this. We have to begin to cultivate infinite love, infinite patience, infinite tolerance, and infinite trust and cooperation. We have to restore that ourselves, and we have to show at least that we have the willingness to restore that to ourselves so that the higher orders of reality can understand that at least some of us are trying.
And is the galactic core, the center of our galaxy, related to this whole business?
Yeah, well, I think that when we talk about the galactic core, we're talking about a intelligence, what you might call it, like an intelligence frequency transmitter that is continuously sending out waves of plasmas, of high frequency beams, of higher dimensional structures that are being emanated from this galactic core. These beams, these higher dimensional frequency structures that are emanated out from the core affect the different solar systems and planetary fields, and they actually have much to do with the instigation of different evolutionary cycles and what you might call the upgrading of the mental programming of the different systems within the whole galactic field. So at this point, and since 1987, actually, we have been experiencing an increase of frequencies from this galactic core, which the Mayans, ancient Mayans, defined or called the Hunab-Ku, the one giver of movement and measure. And we have been receiving new information streams, new knowledge streams, that to those who are actually clear and receptive, that these streams of information are hooking them up to higher dimensional levels of communication and intelligence, and providing what you might call some guidance to the system at this point.
Remarkable. All right, Dr. Arguelles, it is about 4 minutes before the top of the hour here. I would normally take a break, but because we're only going to do an hour interview, I will ask you if you'd like to consider sticking around for a little bit longer. Certainly the listeners are all screaming at me to ask, and certainly that you're under no obligation, but I will put it out there and offer you some more time if you'd like to talk further. If not, we've got a few more minutes, and you could sort of wrap it up with anything that you'd like to.
Yeah, well, I think I'm going to have to wrap it up, Mike.
No problem.
I appreciate the people who like to have me speak longer, but I think that if you hear clearly what I'm saying, you'll get the picture, you'll get the message. We really are in a position where I think the major issue is how we take responsibility for our own lives and for our own minds, for our own thoughts, for our own actions, and for our own words. We live in a very, very fast-paced world where we're not only adding 10,000 blogs a day, but each of us is bombarded by at least 10,000 images a day.
Mm-hmm.
And so our discriminatory powers are tending to be somewhat weakened in this process, and we all have to kind of like take time to remove ourselves a little bit from this world in whatever way we can, even if we're living in a modern life type of situation, of actually taking the time in our own lives to not be on the internet, not be on the television, to just sit quietly with ourselves and with the great unknown, with the supreme creator, or however we want to call this, and see if we can come into contact with our own divine primal essence. I think that's more important, because when it all starts coming down, what's going to matter is what kind of relationship we have to our own divine essence. Have we been able to contact ourselves? Have we actually been able to be honest and truthful with ourselves? Have we been able to really clear ourselves away from the whole welter of images and slogans and marketing cliches that bombard us and seek to overwhelm us and to capture our souls with slogans and ways of thinking that have actually nothing to do with our own true essence, with our own nature, with the truth of cosmic reality. We are really, really, in our essence, cosmic beings. We are truly, in our deepest essence, aspiring to come into the highest and greatest cosmic consciousness, to expand in great, great waves of radiating love and compassion. And this is what we want in our truth. But our minds are so dazed and so overwhelmed by the different patterns of thought and marketing that we really need to each have the courage to take the time to withdraw from this world at least some moments a day, hours a day, do something different on the weekend. But we really have to take time out and to come into contact with our own essence. And in that essence, in the very, very great stillness of our own mind, see what other voices we can hear.
Jose, very quickly, you mentioned Terence McKenna earlier. I mentioned Maria Sabina. Without a long answer required, do you have a position on the visionary plants?
Well, you know, they represent a stage, I think, in the evolutionary process for some people. They're there, and that's what they have to use. And there's no question that there have been particular stages in the life of our culture that those medicinal plants opened doors of perception for us. I think that the problem is that we, as I said, we have a lack of discriminatory mind.
Yes.
And so we have to be very, very cautious in the use of that and the conditions of the use, and realize that all they're doing is opening doors to our own infinite divine potential. We are each an infinite root. We are each a cosmic vibratory root. Sometimes these medicinal plants help us reach that, but once we reach it, we have to realize that was only an instrument, a door that was opened. But now we have to be alone with what it is, with the actual essence of our nature, and that we have to be thankful that if we reached it through those means, we have to be thankful, and then we have to be thankful that we have reached our essence, and then commune with that alone.
It's a wonderful answer. Thank you so much. Dr. Arguelles, I can't tell you what a pleasure it has been, or I will tell you what a pleasure it has been. It has been a tremendous pleasure, and I thank you so much, and I honor you for the work that you're doing and that you've done for all of these years, and just know that there are a lot of people that are tuning in to all of this stuff, and you're very welcome here, and we all love you, and thank you very much for your work.
Yeah, I feel your heart very, very sincerely, Mike, and I very much appreciate the opportunity, and sending out all my love to everybody and wishing everybody the highest and the best, and that everybody can come to some real genuine understanding of what is actually going on. God bless you and take care.
And to you. Take care, Jose.
Thank you, Mike.
Bye-bye. Ladies and gentlemen, Jose Antonio Arguelles Valum Votan, thank you so much. It's Mike. You've been listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. This is Canal. The song is called Oxlahun.
nature and the mind in harmony. Oh, I feel the time spiral.
KOPN Columbia. It's Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit. About 7 minutes after 1 a.m. now on the 20th of March, 2007. Happy equinox to y'all. And I hope you enjoyed the time that we did get to spend with Dr. Jose Arguelles. We did about an hour and, I don't know, just about an hour, but commercial free. You don't get that very often, so... Anyway, I hope you enjoyed it, and I'll get it up on the web as soon as possible, and that's when I think that it might be worthwhile to share with lots of people. Let you guys decide that for yourselves, all right? The audio quality wasn't the best, but it was from New Zealand, and all by my lonesome here in the middle of the night. It's as good as it gets. I sort of like these now, because you sort of have to pay attention. Sorry, that's my excuse. Anyway, wonderful stuff. Thank you so much, Dr. Arguelles, one last time. Let's see. What should we do? Let me go peek in the chat room and say hello to everyone over there. I don't know if there's any questions. There are probably lots of questions that have come up during the course of the program. And I didn't, you know, I just had a list of things that I had to get in. And, in fact, there are many things that I didn't get in. But the ones that I thought were the biggies, I tried to cover. And you want to chat about it with me now, you know, and we can always talk about it amongst ourselves. I'll take a look in the chat room here if people have questions or comments. Take a look there. And if you want to give me a call and talk to me on the air, you can do that at area code 573-443-8255. And I'm glad to say hello to anybody who's interested in talking. So, let's see. What else? Thank you, Chaos. All right. Well, I'll tell you something. From email here, Jay's film, 2012, The Odyssey, you didn't mention it. I'm sorry I didn't. And it's one of the things that I had spoken with John about, John Major Jenkins, when we visited recently. We were interested in what Jose Arguelles' take on the film was that Jay Widener and Sharon Rose had produced, because he has a pretty significant part in the film. They interview him, and there's, I don't know, maybe 10, 15 minutes with Jose that's in the final cut of the movie. And John was interested to see what he had thought about the film, as was I, and I'm sure other people, but we didn't get there. Sorry about that. Well, the other thing that we didn't really get to talk about that I was hoping to a little bit was what his take was on all the other 2012ers. You know, Jose has openly talked about Tony Shearer and that he was instrumental in his early work, his early journey. But now, you know, there are others, John Major Jenkins, Carl Kalaman, all a host of others, you know, jumping into this whole 2012 business for, I'm sure, a lot of reasons. And I wanted to ask him, you know, what his thoughts were about the other men and women that were now talking and writing about 2012 and all this stuff, but we didn't get a chance to do that either. But, you know, he frankly put his words out there and his ideas and opinions about what is happening. Take it for what they're worth, you know. All right. You know, I'll do something here, since it's still sort of in tone with the whole show, and then maybe at the bottom of the hour we'll do some news and some other things. But I think right now I'm going to read something to you. You know, I mentioned before the Jose Arguelles interview that on the 17th, which was Saturday, St. Patrick's Day, was the anniversary of Maria Sabina's birthday. And I really can't tell you how important I think this woman was in sort of where we are as an historical, you know, experiential people. And I'm going to read a piece of literature that was written by Robert Gordon Wasson. And it's actually an excerpt from a book that's called Hallucinogenic Fungi of Mexico. And it's called, well, it's titled Be Mushroomed. So I'll read this to you. Check it out, all right? Then I'll play another song from Canal coming up here, and then we can talk about the news or anything else you guys want. Put some questions up on the chat page, and I'll peek in there, and I'll go look at the forum, see what sort of news items are being posted up there. But in the meantime, listen to this. Again, Robert Gordon Wasson from Hallucinogenic Fungi of Mexico. Be Mushroomed. I do not recall which of us, my wife or I, first dared to put into words back in the 40s the surmise that our own remote ancestors, perhaps 4,000 years ago, worshipped a divine mushroom. In the fall of 1952, we learned that the 16th century writers described the Indian cultures of Mexico. They had recorded that certain mushrooms played a divine role in the religion of the natives. The so-called mushroom stones really represented mushrooms, and that they were the symbol of a religion, like the cross in the Christian tradition, or the Star of Judea, or the crescent of the Muslims. Thus we find a mushroom in the center of the cult with perhaps the longest continuous history in the world. We have found this cult of the divine mushroom a revelation in the true meaning of that abused word, though for the Indians it is an everyday feature, albeit a holy mystery, of their lives. There are no apt words to characterize your state when you are, shall we say, bemushroomed. What we need is a vocabulary to describe all the modalities of a divine inebriant. These difficulties in communicating have played their part in certain amusing situations. Two psychiatrists who have taken the mushroom and known the experience in its full dimension have been criticized in professional circles as being no longer objective. Thus we are all divided into two classes, those who have taken the mushroom and are disqualified by our subjective experience, and those who have not taken the mushroom and are disqualified by their total ignorance of the subject. I am profoundly grateful to my Indian friends for having initiated me into the tremendous mystery of the mushroom. Of alcohol they speak with the same jocular vulgarity that we do, but about mushrooms they prefer not to speak at all, at least not when they are in company, and especially when strangers, white strangers, are present. Then, when evening and darkness come, and you are alone with a wise old man or woman whose confidence you have won, by the light of a candle held in the hand, talking in a whisper, you may bring up the subject. They are never exposed in the marketplace, but pass from hand to hand by prearrangement. The Aztecs, before the Spanish arrived, called them Teonacatal, God's flesh. I need hardly remind you of a disquieting parallel, the designation of the elements in the Eucharist. Take, eat this, my body. And again, grant us therefore, gracious Lord, so to eat the flesh of thy dear Son. The Orthodox Christian must accept by faith the miracle of the conversion of the bread into God's flesh. That is what is meant by the doctrine of transubstantiation. By contrast, the mushroom of the Aztecs, the Maya, carries its own conviction. Every communicant will testify to the miracle that he has experienced. In the language of the Mazatec, the sacred mushrooms are called Nitzito. The first word is a particle expressing reverence and endearment. The second element means that which springs forth. The little mushroom comes of itself, and no one knows whence. Like the wind that comes, we know not whence nor why. For more than four centuries, the Indians have kept the divine mushroom close to their hearts, sheltered from the desecration by white men, a precious secret. We know that today there are many curanderos and curanderas who carry on the cult, each according to his light. Some of them consummate artists, performing the ancient liturgy in remote huts before minuscule congregations. They are hard to reach, these curanderos. Do not think that it is a question of money. Perhaps you will learn the names of a number of renowned curanderos, and your emissaries will even promise to deliver them to you, but then you wait and wait, and they never come. You will brush past them in the marketplace. They will know you, but you will not know them. The judge in the town hall may be the very man you are seeking, and you may pass the time of day with him, yet never learn he is your curandero. After all, would you have it any different? What priest of the Catholic Church will perform Mass to satisfy an unbeliever's curiosity? Religion in primitive society was an awesome reality, terrible in the original meaning of the word, pervading all life and culminating in ceremonies that were forbidden to the profane. Let me point out certain parallels between our Mexican rite and the mysteries performed at Eleusis. At the heart of the mystery of Eleusis lay a secret. In the surviving texts, there are numerous references to the secret, but in none is it revealed. From the writings of the Greeks, from a fresco in Pompeii, we know that the initiate drank a potion. Then, in the depths of the night, he beheld a great vision, and the next day was still so awestruck that he felt he would never be the same man as before. What the initiate experienced was new, astonishing, inaccessible to rational cognition. It also seems significant that the Greeks were wont to refer to mushrooms as the food of the gods, Bromathion, and that Porphyrius is quoted as having called them nurslings of the gods. They were not for mortal men to eat, at least not every day. We might be dealing with what is in origin a religious taboo. I do not suggest that St. John of Patmos ate mushrooms in order to write the Book of Revelation, yet the succession of images in his vision so clearly seen, but such a phantasmagoria, means for me that he was in the same state as one bemushroomed. The advantage of the mushroom is that it puts many, if not everyone, within the reach of the state without having to suffer the mortifications of Blake and St. John. It permits you to see more clearly than our perishing mortal eye can see, vistas beyond the horizons of this life, to travel backwards and forwards in time, to enter other planes of existence, even as the Indians say, to know God. All that you see during this night has a pristine quality. The landscape, the edifices, the carvings, the animals, they look as though they had come straight from the Maker's workshop. The newness of everything, it is as if the world had just dawned, overwhelms you, melts you with its beauty. All these things you see with an immediacy of vision that leads you to say to yourself, now I am seeing for the first time, seeing direct, without the intervention of mortal eyes. It is clear to me where Plato found his ideas. It was clear to his contemporaries, too. Plato had drunk of the potion in the temple of Eleusis, and had spent the night seeing the great vision. And all the time you are seeing these things, the priestess sings, not loud, but with authority. Your body lies in the darkness, heavy as lead, but your spirit seems to soar and leave the hut, and with the speed of thought to travel where it wishes in time and space, accompanied by the shaman singing and by the ejaculations of her percussive chant. What you are seeing and what you are hearing appears as one. The music assumes harmonious shapes, giving visual form to its harmonies, and what you are seeing takes on the modalities of music, the music of the spheres. All your senses are similarly affected. The cigarette with which you occasionally break the tension of the night smells as no other cigarette before has ever smelled. The glass of water is infinitely better than champagne. The bemushroomed person is poised in space, a disembodied eye, invisible, incorporeal, seeing but not seen. In truth, he is the five senses disembodied, all of them, keyed to the height of sensitivity and awareness, all of them blending into one another most strangely, until the person, utterly passive, becomes a pure receptor, infinitely delicate, of sensations. As your body lies there in a sleeping bag, your soul is free. It loses all sense of time, but alert as never before, living in an eternity in a night, seeing infinity in a grain of sand. What you have seen and heard is cut, as with a burn, into your memory, never to be effaced. At last you know what the ineffable is, and what ecstasy means. The mind harks back to the origin of that word. For the Greeks, ecstasis meant the flight of the soul from the body. I can find no better word to describe the mushroom state. In common parlance, among the many who have not experienced ecstasy, ecstasy is fun, and I am frequently asked why I do not reach for mushrooms every night. But ecstasy is not fun. Your very soul is seized and shaken until it tingles. After all, who will choose to feel undiluted awe or to float through that door yonder into the divine presence? The knowing abuse the word, but we must recapture its full and terrifying sense. As man emerged from his brutish past thousands of years ago, there was a stage in evolution of his awareness when the discovery of a mushroom with miraculous properties was a revelation to him, a veritable detonator of the soul, arousing in him sentiments of awe and reverence and gentleness and love, to the greatest pitch of which mankind is capable, all those sentiments and virtues that mankind has ever since regarded as the highest attributes of his kind. It made him see what the perishing mortal eye cannot see. The Greeks were right to hedge about the mystery, this imbibing of the potion with secrecy and surveillance. What today is resolved into the effects of a mere drug, a tryptamine or lysergic acid derivative, was for them a prodigious miracle, inspiring in them poetry, philosophy, religion. Perhaps with all our modern knowledge we do not need the divine mushroom anymore. Perhaps we need them more than ever. Some are shocked that the key to religion might be reduced to a drug. On the other hand, the drug is as mysterious as it ever was, like the wind it cometh we know not whence nor why. If our classical scholars were given the opportunity to attend the rite at Eleusis, to talk with the priestess, they would exchange anything for that chance. They would approach the precincts, enter the hallowed chamber with the reverence born of the texts venerated by scholars for millennia. And what would be their frame of mind if they were invited to partake of the potion? Well, those rites take place now, unbeknownst to the classical scholars, in scattered dwellings, humble, thatched, without windows, far from the beaten track. If it is the rainy season, perhaps the mystery is accomplished by torrential rains and punctuated by terrifying thunderbolts. Then indeed, as you lie there bemushroomed, listening to the music and seeing visions, you know a soul-shattering experience, recalling as you do the belief of some primitive people that mushrooms, sacred mushrooms, are divinely engendered by Jupiter Fulmanus, the god of the lightning bolt and the soft Mother Earth. This is Mike Hagen. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
I'll leave.
Canal. The song is called Desert Flower. You can hear that on their CD called Dreamwalker, and you can also find more information about the band on the web at www.canal.org. Great stuff, and really pleased to be able to share it with you guys tonight. All right, and it's Mike, Radio Orbit, KOPN, Columbia, 89.5 FM, about 1:30 now, a little bit past that, 1:36, something like that, in the AM, 20th of March 2007, closing in on the vernal equinox, the spring equinox in the northern hemisphere, welcoming in spring and summer, and looking very forward to it. So, all right, let me take a peek here on the web and say hello to everybody, by the way. There's a question asked by one of the people in the chat room. An interesting question. I'm not really sure if I know how to answer it, but it has to do with this. There's this image on a website. It's sort of proliferated around the web. It shows up here and there, but the image has a name. It's called Musha Man or Musha Man, and it says Dimitri underneath it, and it's an image of a shaman with an interesting sort of black and white striped polka-dotted get-up on, and the shaman is sort of morphing out of the top of a mushroom cap. And at any rate, a person asked a question about the relationship between the bees. You know, and we were just talking about bee mushroomed. And he asked about if this might be some sort of a cosmic joke, perhaps, something pointing to the symbiotic relationship between these species. And you know, I never thought about it like that, but who knows? It does look sort of like a bee. He points out that the outfit that the shaman is sort of shown wearing looks, yeah, I mean, you could sort of see a bumblebee in there, some stripes, and especially around the neck and the collar area there. At any rate, I don't know. Who knows? But it is interesting what's happening with the bees. We didn't talk a whole lot about the details, but it's really weird because it's not like they're all being found dead. They're finding, it's weird, it's like talk about the Maya, it's sort of like the Maya, they just disappeared, it's sort of like the Anasazi, they just disappeared. And these bees, they're just not there, like they open up their hives, they're not finding a whole bunch of dead bees, they're finding no bees. It's very strange. So, anyway, I don't know, we'll have to see what's happening with that, but the mushroom itself, I don't think is reliant upon, you know, the traditional means of pollinization that the bees carry out. Mushrooms are pretty much, man, they're sort of autonomous. They don't need a whole lot of help, although they love the help of animals, for sure, eating them and spreading their spores all around. Of course, everyone has a symbiote. My impression has always been that we are one of the primary symbiotes of the mushroom. Not so much the bees, perhaps, but the mushrooms are a symbiote for human beings. And I really appreciated what Jose had to say about that whole business, because he made wonderful points with a great deal of clarity. And you know, to try to collapse it into a few words, he basically said, this stuff cannot be messed with, and you have to be very careful and smart, intelligent, and heartfelt, and a lot of other things when you go into these places, because it's not a joke. And one of the problems that we've had with psilocybin in particular, and many things in general, in the Western culture, is that since they've been introduced, and this is coming around now, but you know, in the earlier days, there was no knowledge, very little knowledge, of the historical relevance of these plants, these mushrooms, the fact that they were incorporated into, you know, many, many cultures and societies, probably for a million years, up until about, well, you know, it faded out in, you know, the latter days of the garden, I guess. And we fell into history. And, you know, Dennis had an amazing revelation. Dennis McKenna, of course, I'm talking about, that Terence relates in True Hallucinations, that book, about the mushroom at the end of history, and that the atom bomb, the nuclear weapon, all of these things which sort of corresponded to their showing themselves, you know, on the scene very shortly after the discovery and use of atomic weapons, the mushroom came back, and it was through Maria Sabina and then Gordon Wasson and Valentina Wasson. You know, Wasson was a banker. He was a vice president or something for J.P. Morgan. No kidding. He was a mycologist by hobby, but he was a banker. He worked for J.P. Morgan. How great is that? Come on, now that's the beauty of the mushroom, because see, the mushroom loves comedy and irony. But that's beautiful. And fittingly enough, his wonderful wife, Valentina, was a pediatrician. Somebody who cared about children, you know? So, anyway, they did a remarkable thing. They came back. There was an amazing story in Life magazine that came out, 1957, I think it was. Fast forward 14 years, you know, the stuff pretty much went untouched, even though it had become publicized quite a bit. The story in Life magazine was very, very popular and drew a tremendous amount of interest. But the mushrooms weren't available here, and nobody even knew what they were, really. And then Terence and Dennis went down there and had their whole amazing experience at La Churrera in 1971, which we mentioned last week, was just, you know, the anniversary of which was just a couple of weeks ago on the 4th and 5th of March. And they were able to figure out how to grow them. And they're the ones that unleashed the mushroom in North America. Terence and Dennis McKenna. They're the ones. And certainly they would not have been able to do it were it not for Robert Gordon Wasson and Valentina, etc., and Maria Sabina, etc., blah, 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 on down the line. But the mushroom has an agenda as well, I should say. And to quote Dennis again, you know, the monkeys only think they're running the show. My friend Jeff Kernut, who is a member of the band Yachai, and also has a satellite project that he calls Sorcerer, there's a song on that CD that's called Animals Are Things Invented by Plants to Help Move Seeds Around. And I, you know, I increasingly intuit that that is more the case than not. If nothing else, we are equal partners, you know. If nothing else, we are equal partners. And anyway, Stephen Buhner comes to mind as well when we talk about this stuff. I mean, talk about intelligence and nature. Somebody mentioned Jeremy Narby on the website a little bit earlier as well. But, yeah, it's remarkable stuff and a remarkable time. And like Jose says, if we're open to this stuff, you can communicate with nature, with or without mushrooms. You know, my own personal opinion is that, you know, in the right state of mind, in the right set, in the right setting. A lot of things have to be right. You have to be the right person. You have to be right with yourself. All this stuff. Again, I take it very seriously. You know, but in this situation, certainly, the mushrooms can be very enlightening and help in your personal life and to a certain extent in the transformation of your social life and world. So, anyway, MacPro is writing about how mushroom spores are one of the only living things that we know that can exist in the vacuum of space. This is something that Fred Hoyle, the famous astronomer, was very keen on, as a matter of fact. He's one of the primary progenitors of the so-called panspermia theories. This is the idea that comets and other astral bodies, as they traverse around the galaxy, they have encounters with other celestial bodies, sometimes planets, sometimes moons, sometimes others of themselves. But when they do have encounters with other objects, and if they get really close to them or if they actually impact them, they can actually grab some of the material from the object that they collide with and then trail that stuff along with them wherever else they're going. You know, if a comet bounces off a moon, if there's something growing on that moon, you know, the impact will blast a bunch of it up into the space, and then it will be grabbed along in the comet's tail and become part of that little system. And Hoyle and other people, Fred Hoyle's the name that comes to mind right off the bat, but there are many other people that believe in this idea, said, yeah, this is a great way to describe how life might populate across, you know, the vastness of space. You might actually have, you know, life moving through space the same way it sort of moves through the biosphere here on Earth. And of course, if you think in a fractal nature, and if you think about time and space the way Jose Arguelles was talking about it earlier in the show, you'll see that this isn't that far out of a notion. Things act the same way regardless of scale. You know, that's one of the revolutions of science that's yet to be really acknowledged, is that the universe is similar, self-similar, over different scale. It's the same. You know, there's a reason that an atom looks like a solar system, looks like a galaxy. There's a reason for it. And there's a reason, you know, for life moving through a particular biosphere or environment, and there's no reason to assume that life won't move through the galaxy and the solar system in a similar sort of fashion. You know, I'm not sure who said it, but perhaps the next big acknowledgement and hence advancement in science will be the recognition that the galaxy is no barrier to life. Our understanding is the barrier. So, anyway, let's see what else is happening here. Oh, boy, let's see. Well, I'm going to go take a peek over here at Ray Kurzweil's site. He always has interesting stuff to talk about. Almost Human by Lee Gutkind. Scientists pursue the goal of robots that think. Here's two stories that sort of diametrically oppose one another. Listen to these two, okay? Making robots think. This is from the Los Angeles Times. Making robots think is an entertaining peek behind the scenes at engineers of the groundbreaking Robotics Institute, much of whose research is funded by NASA, the National Science Foundation, and the Defense Department. There's a huge conference going on, a tremendous amount of money being spent on thinking robots, and their goal is to try to approach human, quote-unquote, intelligence. They may approach human intellect, but they will not approach intelligence, at least not for a while, I don't think. Here's the next one. A quiet death for the bold project to map the mind. This is from the Star Ledger. DARPA, that's the Defense Armed Research Project Administration, what the hell, I don't know what it is, DARPA. Ah, yes, Defense Advanced Research Project Administration or Association, something like that. Big government agency, sort of a black agency that they do lots of stuff covertly, lots of secret sort of funded projects and all this stuff. Anyway, DARPA has killed the BICA. That's an acronym for Biologically Inspired Cognitive Architecture. DARPA has killed the BICA project to reverse engineer the human brain. The brain effort linked experts from neuroscience, cognitive psychology, robotics, artificial intelligence, all who wanted to replicate how different parts of the brain interact. In some ways, it was like a Manhattan Project or the Apollo Project. Building a brain is a big task, said genius Randall O'Reilly. I added the genius. An associated professor at the University of Colorado Boulder. No, it's much more than the Manhattan Project. Much more than the Apollo Project. Those were projects that actually were completed, you see. This is one. See, because it's not just science. It's not just chemistry. The psyche has yet to be figured out or explained by anybody to any reasonable degree. I've been reading all kinds of Carl Jung lately, right? And, I mean, he was amazing and writing things 50 years ago that were far more profound than the stuff I'm reading today. But even he was, you know, stretching, trying to find words, trying to describe something that nobody can describe, you know? So the idea that you're going to build something out of machines and transistors and glass and ceramic and metal and plastic, and you're going to somehow animate that. See, this is the problem. You might be able to build the architecture, something that mimics the architectonics of the brain. What about the heart? That's involved in it too, isn't it? What about the stomach? What about the entire neural network? See, we have this cracked brain idea that the brain is sort of a standalone, that it functions completely autonomously from the rest of its system. No, it doesn't. Just like us, it is a symbiote. What is the brain without the heart? What is a computer brain without a computer heart? You see? So much of this has yet to be, I think, even recognized by mainstream scientists that are just piddling away in the laboratories, you know, trying to build more and more sophisticated machines. That's great and everything, but I think it's missing the point. Anyway, let's see. McKinney. Who's McKinney? Somebody says, Mike's even get McKinney on the show. I'm not sure who that is. You mean McKinney? James McKinney? The guy that, the comic guy, the Electric Universe guy? You know, I've been trying to get those guys from the Electric, you know, the guys who talk about the Electric Universe ideas. The idea that, you know, electroplasma ideas are what are really affecting the way the solar system and the galaxy works. Interaction between the sun, planets, comets, asteroids, stars, moons, all this stuff. But I've yet to be successful in getting them to come on the show. So anyway, Jim McKinney, I'm not sure, you know, if that's who you're talking about. What else here? AIDS cure announced by Iran and now Gambia. And both of these, interestingly, are related to herbs, natural solutions. I don't know if any of it's been validated or what's going on, but you're going to start to see more of this, I think. I think you're going to start to see, you know, cures for things popping out of the ground, you see, not popping out of Merck or Eli Lilly. Those are the things that are going to kill you. But more and more people are just sort of, I think if you're open to it, you'll be able to benefit probably if you look into natural solutions to many of the problems that we typically would go to, you know, an allopath for. And you may need it. You know, if there's as big a wrench coming as many of these people say is coming, and Jose alluded to the fact that
there's going to be more and more intense and profound change. And for people who aren't prepared for that sort of thing, it's going to be very difficult, perhaps. You know? So things might get rough. Who knows what's going to happen? But if we've learned anything in the last 5 years, 6 years, you know, it should be that we need to take responsibility for ourselves, for our own actions and our own health and all that stuff. So, anyway, this is an amazing announcement from some doctors in Iran, some scientists in Iran, and then actually the president of Gambia. But like I say, yet to be sort of validated, but interesting stuff happening all around the world. And the ability to share these stories, the way they move now, how quickly they travel, is remarkable and great and amazing. Let's see, what else here? Scientists threatened for climate denial. This is an interesting thing that's happening in the whole climate change debate. It's now getting like, you know, if you don't buy into it, then you become someone who's sort of persecuted. Now, I've always said, and my position is pretty clear, if it's not, I'll say it again, that global climate change, whatever you want to call it, something is happening for sure. I've always just said that nobody really knows what's happening. And if you don't really know, and I mean really know, you know, you can say, well, it's probably a little bit of this and a little of that, and maybe the CO2 is doing this, and maybe the la, la, la. I mean know what's happening. Nobody really knows what's happening. Because if you knew what was happening, you actually would know what to do about it. Or I should say, know that you couldn't do anything about it. The idea that people prescribe solutions to something that they have no understanding of is preposterous and probably dangerous. So, anyway, the world is a-changing. That is for sure. And if you don't believe it after this program, well, damn, then you better start doing your change-related calisthenics, because the stuff that's coming down the pike is going to knock your socks. All right? That's all I've got to say, really, for this evening. And we'll leave it at that, okay? Thanks to everyone for listening to the program. I'll be back next week. We'll talk with Eric John Phelps, the author of Vatican Assassins. I'll mention Jose's websites really quickly one more time here. www.lawoftime.org, www.tortuga.com. You'll be able to link from here on out from my site at MikeHagan.com. I thank you all so much for listening. Stick around. We got Crash Landing with Ruth coming up with some good music in a few minutes. I'll close out here with one last one from my friends Canal. This one's called Holy Ground. Ain't the truth. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. I'll talk to you all next week. Thanks again for listening. Beautiful.
spaces in between.
Between.